prose is the most controlling storytelling medium. Like other media, prose can view scenes from anywhere in the physical world, but it also adds subjective angles from within a character's mental world. Once the prose writer makes a choice of person, first, third, or the eccentric second, her eye moves from that angle like a spotlight. The author holds our perception in her fist. As we follow her sentences, she takes us where she wishes, through the places, times, and societies of her world, or into a single character's thought-filled depths, there to witness rationalizations, self-deceptions and dreams, or, deeper yet, into the character's subconscious to reveal her raw appetites, nightmarish terrors, and lost memories. When skillfully executed, POV has such power that unless we deliberately stop, pull out of the telling, and put our imaginations to work, we are drawn through the tale, seeing and hearing only what the storyteller wants us to, and no more. Therefore, in the following analysis, when I describe Tom Buchanan's reaction to Daisy's abrupt snuffing out of the candles, I am imagining the scene the way Fitzgerald might have imagined it before he wrote the final draft. Like all fine writers, Fitzgerald no doubt worked through the scene draft after draft, adding, cutting, reordering, phrasing, and rephrasing until he had a sense of its totality. And as he reworked the scene, he likely imagined it from each and every character's viewpoint, even though he knew that he would ultimately control his prose through Nick's point of view. Now to the scene. Suppose you prepared a romantic candlelit dinner, and your spouse abruptly snuffed out the candles without a word or look to you. What would you feel? How would you react? Tom must have been offended. So to analyze the full life of Fitzgerald's mini-drama, I must recreate the scene as he envisioned it before he wrote it, and include the reactions that Fitzgerald chose to imply but not describe. Inciting incident. As the scene opens, Daisy's and Tom's life seems contented and in balance. The value of marriage versus divorce is at its positive charge. But secretly, Daisy finds married life very tedious. Her inner charge of excitement versus boredom sits at the nadir. Beat 1. Action. Jordan revealing that Gadsby lives in West Egg. Reaction. Daisy concealing her surprise. Beat 1 triggers the novel's inciting incident. Daisy discovers that Jay Gadsby has moved nearby. What's more, Jordan and Nick know him. This revelation immediately throws her life out of balance. The positive charge of marriage versus divorce begins to erode toward the negative, while her excitement for Gadsby resurfaces. In her late teens, Daisy fell passionately in love with Jay Gadsby. Their rich girl, poor boy affair ended when Gadsby left to fight in World War I. Soon after their breakup, the socially ambitious Daisy married the wealthy Tom Buchanan. In recent years, Gadsby has become scandalously rich and famous. Daisy has no doubt read or heard about his exploits. She may have also learned that he purchased a huge estate across the bay. In fact, Gadsby bought the home so he could look across the narrow waters to the lit windows of her home. When Daisy asks, "What Gadsby?" she knows full well it's Jay Gadsby, but she cleverly uses the question to conceal her genuine surprise to learn that her former lover is now a virtual neighbor, and furthermore, that her friend knows him and her cousin lives near him. The realization that Gadsby has moved close to her, undoubtedly drawn to West Egg because of her, upsets the balance of Daisy's life and arouses in her the desire to see him, to renew their love, to have an affair, leave her husband. Who can say how far she intends to go? Daisy's fluidly fickle nature makes her incapable of decisive plans into the future, but this much is clear. Her superintention is, at the very least, to see Jay Gatsby. Gatsby becomes her object of desire. This puts two core values into play, marriage versus divorce, and boredom versus passion. The security of her marriage versus her passion for Gatsby. She must risk the former to gain the latter. Daisy's choice? To keep marital peace or go to war. At the top of the scene, the value charges are positive for Daisy's marriage. Before dinner, husband and wife are amiable, but negative for Daisy's passion. Gatsby is out of reach. Beyond seeing Gatsby, exactly what Daisy wants from him, Fitzgerald deliberately hides in the subtext. But note Daisy's choice. She risks her marriage and goes to war with her husband. Beat 2. Action, all walking to the dinner table. Reaction, Daisy planning to humiliate Tom. Daisy's problem is that she cannot just pick up a telephone and call Gatsby. Her pride and vanity won't allow it. What's more, if her husband or the rigid, snobbish society she moves in were to discover that she pursued the notorious Gatsby, the scandal would ruin her. Instantly, instinctively, she decides to put on a show in front of Nick and Jordan so that one or both will carry a message to Gatsby, a message that says the Buchanan marriage is in trouble. Daisy takes command of the scene and drives it to its turning point. Her scene intention becomes to humiliate her husband in public. Tom's scene intention, it's fair to assume, is to avoid public humiliation. These directly opposed desires set the scene's terms of antagonism. Tom Buchanan has had his household staff set the dinner table with candles. He may have done it for Daisy's sake, or perhaps he intended this romantic touch to encourage Nick and Jordan. Indeed, in time, those two will have a summer affair. Beat 3. Action. Daisy destroying her husband's romantic gesture. Reaction, Tom concealing his annoyance. But whatever Tom's reason, as they step up to the table, the frowning Daisy objects to the candles and snuffs them out with her fingers. Tom reacts by concealing the hurt she causes him and saying nothing. The positive charge of marriage declines further as Daisy's boredom changes into excitement. Beat 4. Action. Daisy opening a conversational subject. Reaction. Daisy turning the subject back to herself. In this beat, Daisy starts a conversation about the summer solstice. But before anybody can respond to her strange question, she reacts to her own action and ends the topic by referring it back to herself. The value charges of marriage versus divorce and excitement versus boredom are unaffected and remain the same as they were in Beat 3. Beat 5. Action. Jordan and Daisy wondering aloud to the others. Reaction. Daisy calling attention to her finger. The summer season has just begun, so Jordan starts the next beat by suggesting that they plan to do something. Daisy simply continues that action by repeating the question twice, not to her husband, but to Nick. But before Nick can answer, she instantly and literally wraps the conversation around her little finger. The value charges of marriage versus divorce and excitement versus boredom, continue on pause. Beat 6. Action. Daisy accusing Tom of injuring her. Reaction. Tom hiding his reaction in silence. Daisy faces a crisis dilemma. She could insult her husband, negative, which would send a message to Gadsby, positive, or she could protect her marriage, positive, and not win Gadsby's attention, negative. She chooses to accuse her husband of bruising her finger. Again, Fitzgerald gives Tom no visible reaction, not a word of protest. The value charge of marriage versus divorce turns dark, while excitement versus boredom shines. Beat 7. Action. Daisy insulting her husband in public. Reaction. Tom ordering her not to insult him again. Daisy then, with cool irony, insults her husband with a special emphasis on a word she knows he hates, hulking. Finally, Tom objects. Bear in mind that these are educated upper-class characters. So when I use the verb ordering to name Tom's reaction, it's because that's what he's doing in the subtext. Tom is too well-behaved to say, "Damn it, Daisy, never use the word hulking again." But under the phrase, "I hate that word," is an indirect command. Daisy's insult throws marriage versus divorce sharply to the negative, while in the subtext, excitement for Gadsby conquers her boredom. Beat 8. Action. Daisy attacking him a second time. Reaction. Tom retreating in silence. Daisy climaxes the scene by defying her husband's order and repeating the hated word with emphasis. In reaction, Tom once more falls silent. Daisy wins her marital power struggle in 6 beats and humiliates Tom. This duel between husband and wife, Tom's defeat and Daisy's victory, would not be lost on her audience of the very sensitive, observant Nick and the gossipy Jordan Baker. Daisy knows this. Now she hopes they'll carry the news to Gadsby. Daisy has embarrassed her husband, and it has had the effect she wants. As Daisy chooses Gadsby over Tom, her marriage ends in all but name, while her excitement about the future peaks. Dialogue versus description in prose. As mentioned previously, prose writers, with exceptions, tend to keep their dramatized dialogue economical, simple, and plain-spoken. Of the scene's 123 spoken words, 107 are of one syllable, 14 of two syllables, and just 2 of 3 syllables. None of the scene's characters uses metaphors or similes when they speak. Fitzgerald, on the other hand, enriches his descriptions with figurative language such as, "Tom Buchanan compelled me from the room as though he were moving a checker to another square," and "Miss Baker sitting down at the table as if she were getting into bed." When he uses polysyllabic words, they tend to be adverbs that describe tones of voice, contemptuously, accusingly, crossly, and actions, slenderly, languidly, radiantly. The scene's power comes from Daisy's actions in the subtext. Actions that Nick, limited by his first-person point of view, cannot know. Instead, Fitzgerald encourages the reader to see through Daisy's veil of innocence by dropping hints along the way, such as Daisy's demand to know, "What, Gadsby?" Turning point, scene climax. The scene arcs the Buchanan marriage dynamically from positive to negative in 8 beats. In the first beat, their marriage seems respectful and faithful. By the last beat, Daisy's actions reveal a marriage filled with hatred and disrespect as she plots her path back to Gatsby. At the same time, each negative action against the marriage becomes a positive beat for Daisy's desire for the adventure that Gatsby brings to her life. Daisy's tactic works. She wins the war against her husband and gives Jordan and Nick the message they'll carry to Gatsby. The 8-beat progression takes this shape. Beat 1, revealing, then concealing. Beat 2, walking, then planning. Beat 3, destroying, then concealing. Beat 4, opening a subject, then turning the subject to herself. Beat 5, wondering aloud, then turning attention to herself. Beat 6, accusing, then hiding. Beat 7, insulting, then ordering. Beat 8, attacking, then retreating. Each beat tops the previous beat, progressing to the turning point when Daisy defies her husband's order and humiliates him. Each beat, that is, except beats 4 and 5. They seem to be a hole in the dialogue's progression because they are not aimed at Daisy's scene intention. Indeed, they're not, because Fitzgerald uses them for another, larger purpose related to the novel's spine of action. Notice the pattern in beats 4 and 5. Daisy asks a question that opens up a general topic for the others, but then, without pause, before anyone can answer, she instantly draws their interest back to her. Fitzgerald repeats this pattern in Daisy's dialogue throughout the book. In ways that are amusing, sympathetic, or mysterious, Daisy constantly steers all talk back to herself. In other words, Fitzgerald wants us to understand that Daisy is a very beautiful, very charming narcissist. What is the real reason she creates this scene? Why can't she defy her husband, break social convention, and visit Gatsby herself? Why must she send a veiled message through Jordan and Nick? Because narcissists call attention to themselves, never others. For Daisy, it is critical that Gatsby seek her out. Gatsby must come to her. Fitzgerald uses those beats and many others elsewhere to express the dueling spines of action that drive the great Gatsby. Gatsby's obsession with Daisy and Daisy's obsession with Daisy. Chapter 17, Reflexive Conflict. Introduction to the Self. Chapter 1 defined dialogue as any word said by any character to anyone. This traffic of talk runs along 3 distinctive avenues: said to others, said to the reader or audience, and said to oneself. The chapter that follows focuses on the latter 2 tracks, direct address to the reader and inner dialogue between selves. Although the stage and screen limit the use of these 2 modes, for the novelist and the short story writer, they are the stuff of first-person prose. When characters talk directly to the reader, the topic tends to be past events and their impact on themselves. For example, the Museum of Innocence. Whereas when characters talk to themselves, their inner dialogue acts out intradynamic events in the now. These dramatizations of self versus self carry psychological nuance into the depths of the unsayable, for example, Fräulein Elsa. Once again, it's the difference between telling and showing. In the former, a character with less than perfect self-awareness tells us about past inner conflicts and describes their effects. In the latter, a character puts her deep psychology in action in front of us and unknowingly dramatizes inner complexities she could never describe. Needless to say, telling and showing call upon two very different dialogue techniques. An ancient literary convention grants us the godlike power to overhear a character's thoughts, all the while knowing that she is not talking to us. If so, then to whom is she speaking? Dialogue, by definition, is a two-sided exchange between a speaker and a listener. Who, besides us, is listening to her? If she's talking to another self within herself, her mind must be dual. If dual, or even multiple, how does her mind divide itself into selves? Exactly, how many are there? And who are they? How do they link? These questions are neither new nor unique to storytelling. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha taught his followers to ignore all such wonderings because they flow from a false premise that the self exists when in fact it does not. The sense of me, he believed, is an illusionary side effect of uncountable, ever-shifting physical and sensory forces. About the same time, Socrates argued the opposite view. He taught his students that the self not only exists, but you cannot live a meaningful, civilized life without making every effort to know who you are. In the centuries since, this debate over the nature of interpersonal communication has swung back and forth between these two philosophical extremes and remains unsettled at best. Science, on the other hand, has taken a stand. Like Socrates, modern science strives to know the hidden nature of consciousness, but at the same time, like Buddha, it feels misled by intuition. While our sixth sense tells us we have a core of consciousness located behind our eyes, brain scan researchers report that several different mental processes, mediated by different brain regions, collaborate to create this illusion. No single central physical all-controlling self exists. Me is indeed a side effect. On the so-called hard question of consciousness, neuroscience now favors Buddha over Socrates, but without a clear conclusion. Although science cannot ground consciousness in the physical, and philosophy cannot locate it in the metaphysical, artists know exactly where to find the self. When art whistles, the self comes running like a bounding dog. For the storyteller, the self makes its home in the same subjective reaches where it has always lived and thrived. Delusional or not, consciousness of self is the essence of our humanity. If, as science tells us, the self is not confined to a specific lobe of the brain, but emerges out of a composite of sources, so what? It's my composite, and I like it. If, as philosophy claims, the unreliable self shifts and changes from one day to the next, and therefore cannot be known absolutely, so what? It's my changing self, and I enjoy watching it evolve, hopefully into a better person. For prose writers striving to express the inner life, philosophy's deductive logic and science's inductive logic dull aesthetic insight. Neither leverages the inside-out power of the subjective, neither creates the meaningful emotional experience of the self that every major work of story art since Homer inspires. Story does not answer the hard question, it dramatizes it. I think the best approach to creating inner dialogue is simply this. Treat your character's mind like a setting. A world populated with a cast of characters called selves. Let this mindscape sprawl like a cityscape, landscape, or battlefield, a mental mise-en-scène, for the staging of a story. Then move into that world yourself and take up residence in your protagonist's center of consciousness. From this point of view, create inner dialogues that dramatize an answer to the question, what is it to be this particular human being? To return to the question that started this introduction, when a character talks to herself, who besides the reader is listening? To whom is she speaking? Answer, the silent self. As we listen to a character talk to herself, we instinctively know that another side, a quiet side of herself, is listening. In fact, we know this so instinctively that we never think about it. We don't have to because we know, without thinking, that we talk to our personal silent self constantly. Inside every mind, it seems to me, a separate, silent core of being sits back, watching, listening, evaluating, storing memories. If you meditate, you know this self very well. It floats behind you, so to speak, watching you do everything you do, including meditation. If you try to meditate toward this self, it instantly swings around behind you again. You cannot face yourself within yourself, but you always know that your silent self is there and aware, listening to everything you have to say. As inner dialogues of prose cycle between the talking self and the silent self, they generate reflexivity. Reflexive conflict. In the physical sciences, reflexivity refers to a circular or bidirectional relationship between cause and effect. An action triggers a reaction that impacts the action so fast the two seem simultaneous. Some theories of quantum physics argue that at the subatomic level, cause and effect are in fact simultaneous. Action and reaction then lock together, whirling in a gyre. The cause becomes the effect becomes the cause, and neither can be clearly identified as either. In the social sciences, reflexivity signals a kind of codependency between individuals or within groups, institutions, and societies. Once the reflexive spiral begins, neither the action nor its reaction can be assigned as the cause or the effect. The two so intra-influence each other, they seem to happen instantaneously without the need for decisions or even thought. In the art of story, reflexive conflict refers to those inner battles that begin when a character's effort to resolve an inherent dilemma boomerangs back on herself. By taking her impasse inward, her effort to deal with her crisis becomes a cause that only worsens the effect. Self-contradictions generate ever more complex sources of antagonism as causes become effects and effects become causes in an ever-deepening whirl until the conflict itself becomes the reason it cannot be solved. Reflexive conflict translates into dialogue the moment a troubled character starts talking to herself. As I pointed out in Chapter 1, the mind, by its very nature, can step back within itself to observe itself as if it were an object. A person temporarily splits in two to develop a relationship, often critical, between her core self and other sides or aspects of herself. She can project images of her past self, her unattractive self, her better self, her future self. She can feel the presence of her conscience, her subconscious, and above all, her silent, listening self. At times, these relationships may be conflictless, as, for example, when we comfort ourselves with excuses, self-deceptions, or blame placed on others. But more often than not, Our inner selves strike opposing sides in a struggle to make choices, to do the right thing, sacrifice for another, bring a troubled self under control, any of the tumultuous contrarieties of the inner life. Reflexive conflicts can be acted out in the present tense directly or related indirectly in the past tense. On stage and on screen, a character can perform the former in soliloquy and the latter in either dialogue spoken to another character or in direct address to the audience. On page, the protagonist can talk to her other self and act out her inner conflicts in the present tense, for example, Fräulein Elsa, or talk to the reader and describe previous episodes of reflective conflict in the past tense, for example, the Museum of Innocence. Fräulein Elsa. Arthur Schnitzler, the Austrian novelist and playwright, experimented with stream of consciousness throughout his career, beginning in 1901 with the short story Lieutenant Gustl. In the 1924 novella Fräulein Else, he invited readers to eavesdrop on the troubled thoughts of its eponymous protagonist by writing exclusively in first-person inner dialogue. Setup. Elsa, a beautiful 19-year-old Viennese debutante, on holiday with her aunt at an Austrian mountain resort, receives a letter from her mother telling her that her father, a lawyer, has been caught stealing tens of thousands from a client's account. He faces prison or suicide if he can't pay the money back in 2 days. Elsa's mother begs her to save her father by asking Herr von Dorsday, a rich art dealer staying at the spa, for a loan to cover the theft. Elsa, despite her suffocating shame, asks the old man for help. He says he will telegraph the funds to cancel her father's debt the next morning, but only if she repays him in sexual currency that night. These three events, her father's theft, her mother's scheme, Dorsday's proposition, trigger the story's inciting incident and throw Ilsa's life radically and negatively out of balance. Two contradictory desires immediately flood her mind: to save her parents and sacrifice herself versus to save herself and sacrifice her parents. Either way she chooses, a great price must be paid. Because when I say save herself, I mean that literally. Elsa's identity is tied to her morality. If she saves her family, she loses her morality. If she loses her morality, she loses her identity. Trapped in this double bind of irreconcilable goods versus lessers of two evils, Ilsa's only path of action runs between her inner selves. So, for the rest of the afternoon and evening, Ilsa wanders the resort alone, her mind in reflexive chaos. At first, she tells herself to give in, save her family, and endure the disgrace. Then she contradicts herself, choosing instead to reject Dorsday and force her family to pay for its ignominy. At one point she tries to cheer herself up, imagining that surrendering to Dorsday would launch a luxurious career as a mistress to rich men. But then her conscience urges her to defend her moral self and accept poverty with honor. Moral dilemmas like this, played out on a protagonist's mindscape, often spiral into reflexive conflict. For example, as the moment to meet Dorsday nears, Elsa says to herself,
"How huge the hotel is, like a monstrous illuminated magic castle. Everything is gigantic. The mountains, too, terrifyingly gigantic. They've never been so black before. The moon hasn't risen yet. It will rise just in time for the performance. The great performance in the meadow, when Herr von Dorsday makes his female slave dance naked. What dare Van Dor say to me? Now, Mademoiselle Elsa, what are you making such a fuss about? You were ready to go off and be the mistress of strange men, one after the other, and you boggle at the trifle which Herr Van Dorstay asks of you. You were ready to sell yourself for a pearl necklace, for beautiful clothes, for a villa by the sea, and your father's life isn't worth as much as that.
Reflexive dialogue. 14 thoughts ricochet through this passage of inner dialogue. In the first 7, from how huge to hasn't risen yet, Ilsa's imagination projects her terror and sense of frailty onto the frightening, enormous, almost unreal world around her. The word magic gives away her childlike state. Then her mind grabs the last word of the 7th sentence, yet, and free associates to an image of her future self naked and dancing in the moonlight. With a rhetorical question, what's Herr Van Dorsday to me? She tries to shrug off the insinuations in the word slave and feign indifference. But suddenly, her mind seems to segue into another self, armed with a sharp, critical voice. For the next 5 lines, this critical self whiplashes Elsa's core self with a series of damned if you do, damned if you don't insults. The critical self calls her a hypocrite, such a fuss, damned if you don't. Then a slut, mistress of strange men, damned if you do. Then a coward, you boggle, damned if you don't. Then a slut again, sell yourself, damned if you do. And finally, an ingrate, your father's life, damned if you don't. Ilsa's mind spins in reflexive conflict. Which do I want to be, a jewel-decked horror or a cowardly ingrate? She dreads both and wants neither. But question mark after question mark paralyzes her until the passage ends in mental gridlock. Spoiler alert. At the climax of the novel, Elsa's impasse explodes into an act of wild exhibitionism and a drug overdose. As we have seen in previous examples, emotions tend to shorten lines, while rationality tends to lengthen them. As fear races through Elsa, her first 7 thoughts average 4.1 words each. But then the critical self takes charge, and the next 7 lines average 14.5 words. Writing in character. When Arthur Schnitzler published Fräulein Elsa, he was a 62-year-old man writing in the first-person inner voice of a 19-year-old socialite. How is this possible? First, he wrote plays as well as prose, so his dramatist skills must have helped him find words for this character. Then, life experience. He married a 21-year-old actress when he was 41. In fact, over a lifetime, he had many affairs with young women. Each must have given him a chance to hear a fresh voice and imagine life from a new and female point of view. But my best guess is this. In addition to talent, skill, and a practiced ear, Schnitzler could act. Maybe not in front of an audience, but at his desk and pacing his study. He became her. He wrote in character, a technique we will explore in Chapter 19. The Museum of Innocence. Orhan Pamuk published The Museum of Innocence 2 years after winning the 2006 Nobel Prize in Literature. He worked long and hard with novelist Maureen Freely to perfect the English translation. The English edition, rather than the original Turkish, was the likely basis for further translations, 60 languages to date, and so its faithfulness was critical. Setup. Pamuk's novel tells a story of love at first sight and its conflict-filled aftermath. Kemal, a Turkish businessman, has converted a house in Istanbul into a repository of mementos and memories he calls the Museum of Innocence. Like the Taj Mahal, the museum celebrates love. In Kemal's case, 9 passionate years with Fusun, his exquisitely beautiful lover and eventual wife, now deceased. The author's unique narrative strategy places Kemal inside the museum, where he acts as a docent and guide to its exhibits. Pamuk then treats the reader as a visitor to the museum, allowing docent Kemal to speak to the reader in first person as if the reader were the museum's guest. 9 tumultuous, love-soaked years have seasoned docent Kemal into maturity. But living in his memory is the museum's main exhibit, Kemal's previous, immature, ultra-romantic self. Throughout Kemal's youth, this self feverishly sought something he could not grasp. He told himself he was in love with Fusun, and up to a point, he was. But deep within, his true obsession was a passion for passion. He quested after that ancient and elusive absolute, the life-fulfilling, transcendent romantic experience. Fusun merely played a role in his all-consuming drama. Obsessive romantics devour the rites of romance. Quiet walks in moonlight, tireless lovemaking, candlelit dinners, champagne, classical music, poetry, sunsets, and the like. But these enthralling rituals are pointless without an exquisite creature to share them. And so the man in love with romance tragedy begins when he falls for a woman because, and only because, she is gorgeous. Young Kemal, in other words, suffered from the curse of beauty, that insatiable craving for the sublime that makes living a simple life unthinkable. Having created these two selves, docent Kemal and romantic Kemal, the author needed to characterize the two voices and solve 3 dialogue problems. 1. In what tone and manner would the docent self speak to a visitor? 2. How would the docent self express the romantic self's silent inner dialogue? 3. When we hear the romantic Kemal speak, what qualities would texture his voice? The passage that follows answers those questions as docent Kemal talks to us.
I have here the clock, and these matchsticks and matchbooks, because the display suggests how I spent the slow 10 or 15 minutes it took me to accept that Fusun was not coming that day. As I paced the rooms, glancing out the windows, stopping in my tracks from time to time, standing motionless, I would listen to the pain sluicing within me. As the clocks in the apartment ticked away, my mind would fixate on the seconds and the minutes to distract myself from the agony. As the appointed hour neared, the sentiment, "Today, yes, she's coming, now," would bloom inside me, like spring flowers. At such moments, I wanted time to flow faster so that I could be reunited with my lovely at once. But those minutes would never pass. For a moment, in a fit of clarity, I would understand that I was fooling myself, that I did not want the time to flow at all, because Fusun might never come. By 2 o'clock, I was never sure whether to be happy that the hour had arrived, or sad that with every passing minute, her arrival was less likely, and the distance between me and my beloved would grow as that between a passenger on a ship leaving port and the one he had left behind. So I would try to convince myself that not so very many minutes had passed. Toward this end, I would make little bundles of time in my head. Instead of feeling pain every second of every minute, I resolved to feel it only once every 5. In this way, I would take the pain of 5 discrete minutes and suffer it all in the last. But this too was for naught when I could no longer deny that the first 5 minutes had passed, when I was forced to accept that she was not coming. The forestalled pain would sink into me like a driven nail.
Docent Kamal begins this passage in the present tense as if he were standing in front of an exhibit case filled with heirlooms and speaking to a visitor. But the Museum of Innocence is primarily a temporal museum. Its chief artifacts are episodes from a love story taken out of time and placed in its galleries. So Docent Kamal switches to the past tense as he puts Romantic Kamal, trapped in an archived event, on display. Docent Kamal quotes Romantic Kamal just once with four present tense phrases. Today, yes, she's coming, and now, uttered with the staccato of excitement. Other than this exception, Docent Kamal leaves the implied line-by-line thoughts of Romantic Kamal's inner dialogue to the reader, visitor's imagination. In the sixth sentence, a third self, critical Kamal, appears briefly to chide Romantic Kamal for his childish self-deceptions. Docent-guest is a ceremonial relationship, more formal than professor-student. Professors and their students engage in the excitement of ideas, but the docent and museum guest join in a solemn reverence for the past. Therefore, Docent Kamal's dialogue pours out flowing, elegiac sentences. The passage runs 325 words long in 11 sentences that average 29.5 words each. Subordinate clauses in a series build each sentence to a mini-climax. Pain sluicing within me. Distract myself from agony. Fusan might never come, and so on. The passage's formality and grace also suggest that Docent Kamal has relived this scene again and again, recited it to many guests many times, perfecting his wording with each rendition. Although Docent Kamal is no longer the hopeless romantic he once was, nostalgia for romance still fills his voice. He is as much a poet as Docent. So to characterize his protagonist's heightened romantic imagination, Pamuk interlaces Docent Kamal's descriptions with metaphors and similes. Here and there, the docent resorts, as people do, to clichés, sugar-sweet images such as thoughts blooming like spring flowers inside Romantic Kamal, the tear-streaked B-movie scene of a passenger on a departing ship gazing back at a beloved left on the shore. Docent Kamal's most personal language, however, goes dark and animates pain. Liquid pain flows through his body, then takes the form of a driven nail. In the most vivid image of all, he transforms time into the conduit for pain, complete with a mental valve, as it were, that can turn it on and off. Of the passage's 11 sentences, the word would finds its way into all but the first line. Would is the past tense for the verb will, but in this context, the author uses it as a modal to create a soft sense of uncertainty. Feel, for example, the difference between the hard versus soft expression of the same ideas. I listen to, and my mind fixates on, as opposed to, I would listen to, and my mind would fixate on. Instead of the phrase, pain sunk into me, the translator uses, pain would sink into me to give the moment a sense of melancholy. Overall, the frequent repetition of would softens the hard edge of reality and spreads an aura of things happening as much in the character's imagination as in an actual room in the actual past. The phrase would never intimates unknown repetitions, would try, hints at hope and wishing. Taken together, the 10 woods yield an air of things that may or may not happen. The word suggests, and the phrase 10 or 15 further distend the shifting atmosphere until Docent Kamal's dialogue sounds like what it is, a memory in the mind of a failed romantic. Reflexive conflict. Pamuk's writing draws its energy from two sources of reflexive conflict, the tyranny of love and the tyranny of time. The tyranny of love. While engaged to another woman, romantic Kamal met Fusun, a beautiful shop clerk. The lightning of love at first sight struck, and his life veered out of control on a trajectory aimed at the transcendent romantic experience. Romantic Kamal blames fate. But fate is the excuse we use when our subconscious pries our hands off the wheel of life. The arch-romantic wants his beloved with him every minute of every hour of every day. Suffering, her absence causes more suffering as the agony of loneliness feeds on itself, making her absence all the more acute. The more he thinks about it, the worse it gets. If and when she were to finally show up, who knows how his mood might have reversed. The tyranny of time. The clock on the wall measures time, but our inner Big Ben has no hands. Sometimes hours vanish in a glance. Sometimes a minute drags by longer than an Arctic February. Romantic Kamal tries concentrating on time because he thinks it will soothe his torment. As the clocks in the apartment ticked away, my mind would fixate on the seconds and the minutes to distract myself from the agony. But fixating on time makes its passage all the more excruciating. He tries to bring time under control by bundling it, parsing it, speeding it up, slowing it. But his battle to rein time only gives time all the more power to torture him. This is the nature of reflexivity. The character inflicts it on himself and then persists in stirring its poison. Needless to say, reflexive conflict offers the storyteller soaring dialogue opportunities. A final note. Docent Kamal portrays romantic Kamal's passion with a powerful and yet self-obsessed intensity. When Fusun doesn't show up, he might have thought, "My God, did something happen to her? Is she hurt?" But he didn't. Instead, he dissected his painful anticipation of pleasure to the microsecond. For the romantic, it is, as we say, always about him. Chapter 18, Minimal Conflict. Introduction, the balance of text and subtext. Every line of dialogue strikes a balance between the literal meaning of the word said and the unsaid meanings that the reader or audience senses resounding through the subtext. When this balance tilts so that a minor motivation causes a massive vocal response, dialogue sounds hollow and the scene feels forged. Recall the definition of melodrama from Chapter 6, the overwrought expression of limp needs. Like chefs who use rich sauces to hide spoiled food, writers who whip up blubbery stylistics to smother stale content risk the sour odor of melodrama. When balance levels out so that unsaid thoughts and feelings transcribe directly and fully into what is said, we call this blatancy writing on the nose. If a scene's implicit and explicit meanings echo each other, subtext turns into text, depth dries up, lines sound tinny, and the acting clanks. When the balance favors content over form, When minimal words express maximal meaning, dialogue gains its greatest credibility and power. Using Robert Browning's famous phrase, less is more, any word that can be cut should be cut, especially if its loss adds to the line's effect. Sparseness of language gives the reader or audience a chance to peer ever more deeply into the unsaid and unsayable. With few exceptions, when understatement takes the upper hand, dialogue resonates. What follows is a superb example of the fewest possible words used to express the maximum possible feeling and meaning. Lost in Translation. Sofia Coppola wrote and directed Lost in Translation when she was 32. It was her fourth script to reach the screen and her second feature to direct. The film won numerous awards around the world, including an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. Coppola grew up surrounded by artists. She has traveled to Japan many times, and, like all of us, she has won and lost at love. So although it's fair to assume that personal experience influenced Coppola's storytelling, it would be a mistake to treat Lost in Translation as autobiography. Rather, her writing expresses the widely read, finely tuned mind of an artist who uses fiction to express her insights into life's secret places. In Coppola's minimalist writing, dialogue progression does not use arguments to sling words like stones, the conjugal hostilities in A Raisin in the Sun, or manipulations to weave words into a trap, Daisy's malicious feigning in The Great Gatsby. Instead, subtle, indirect, sparse language shapes implicit, virtually invisible, but deeply felt conflicts that haunt her characters out of their pasts and into the present. In the scene that follows, Coppola works into the inner selves and past selves of her characters simultaneously. She reveals both in each without resorting to choices under the pressure of dilemma. Choices between irreconcilable goods and the lesser of two evils, once poised, are profoundly revealing of true character, but relatively easy to dramatize. Coppola takes another path. Her characters are not in conflict with what life imposes, but with the emptiness of what life denies. This quiet scene hooks, holds, and pays off without direct, indirect, or reflexive conflict. Setup. The key to creating a scene of minimum dialogue and maximum impact is in the setup. If, prior to a scene, the storytelling has brought characters to crisis points in their lives, the reader or audience can sense their needs swirling in the subtext. These desires may or may not be conscious, but the reader or audience knows them, feels them, and waits in high tension to see how they play out. A well-prepared reader or audience reads chapters of content implied behind a phrase or gesture. Lost in Translation perfects this technique. The film's opening scenes cross-cut to counterpoint dual protagonists. Charlotte, a recent Yale graduate, traveling with her photographer husband, versus Bob Harris, a middle-aged Hollywood star famous for action roles. As the two settle into the Park Hyatt, Tokyo, we see their differences of age, at least 30 years, fame, everybody ignores Charlotte, everybody fawns on Bob, and marriage, she needs her husband's attention, he wishes his wife would leave him alone. That day, they notice each other in passing twice, once in an elevator and later in the lounge. That night, neither can sleep, so they make their way to the hotel bar where they meet by chance. Scene intentions. As the scene opens, Charlotte and Bob seem to share a simple need, to kill time over a drink. But if all they really wanted was a drink, they could have opened their minibars. Instead, an unthought wish for somebody to talk to sends them out of their rooms. Once they see each other, the scene intention becomes to kill time with talk. Scene values. As Charlotte nears Bob sitting at the bar, tension rises. Earlier that day, she and he exchanged a smile, but suppose he turns out to be an arrogant bore, or he discovers she's a lunatic fan. The question, should I talk to this stranger or drink alone, runs